Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 104. It's Monday, March 8th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, this week, Just for the Health of It is 2 years old. Happy birthday to me. Happy birthday to us. If you are a longtime listener, thank you for sticking with me. If you're a new listener, then thank you as well. We're into year two of my 30-year plan to be discovered overnight. Okay, well, let's get rolling. We have some big news this week in the COVID relief bill, and I'd like to cover a couple parts that are a little less, have been less newsworthy and I think are worth accenting. This bill that's expected to pass this week expands three key tax credits: the child tax credit, the earned income tax credit, and the child and dependent care tax credit. And the reason why this is so critically important is that this is expected to cut adult poverty by one-third in America, and, wait for it, cut child poverty by one-half or more. This is epic New Deal stuff. We're making bold progress in one flail swoop, which doesn't happen too often. So let's see if we can get rid of the other half of child poverty. Well, the other thing that this bill does is it expands the Affordable Care Act eligibility and premium support, and plus it covers over 100% of Medicaid expansion costs, up from 90% of the state costs. So it actually costs money for the dozen states that don't have Medicaid expansion. They would actually make money if they increase their Medicaid. So there's incentives there. Okay, well, let's look at a couple stories related to that. This from USA Today: Biden's COVID-19 relief bill includes an expansion of Obamacare. Here's how it would work. A 64-year-old woman whose $58,000 income puts her out of range for subsidized health insurance through the Affordable Care Act could see her premium drop from $12,900 to $4,950 under President Joe Biden's pandemic relief bill that passed the House passed the Senate on Saturday. A 21-year-old man earning just above the poverty line could purchase a premium-free marketplace plan with a much lower deductible than he qualifies for now. Under the COVID-19 relief bill, the insurance subsidies for people not covered through an employer or government plan, such as Medicare or Medicaid, would become more generous. They would be newly available to people earning more than four times the federal poverty rate. That's about $51,520 for a single person and $106,000 for a family of four. The changes would provide the most savings to people at the income level who are older and live in areas with particularly high premiums. A 60-year-old person making $55,000 per year living in Wyoming, West Virginia, South Dakota, Nebraska, Connecticut, or Alabama could save more than 70% on a mid-range plan, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. The bill would guarantee that people with incomes up to 150% of poverty wouldn't have to pay any premium for a benchmark mid-level plan, a step up from the higher deductible plans they can buy with the current subsidies. That could mean the difference between having a $177 deductible instead of a $6,900 deductible plan. Wow. The increase in the generosity of the premium subsidies is quite significant and would make a very substantial difference both in terms of enrollment and in terms of lowering financial burdens on the population already enrolled, said Linda Bloomberg, an expert on health insurance at the Urban Institute. I think of it as the first step in our broader agenda for improving the law. Advocates and some analysts said that would buy much-needed help when many household budgets are strained. About 9 million people who are uninsured already qualify for a subsidy but aren't taking one. Their top reason is cost, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. The COVID-19 relief bill would increase pressure on the 12 states that have not moved to take the funding created by the ACA to expand Medicaid eligibility, leaving millions of people who are below the poverty line ineligible for government assistance. The Medicaid gap is the really greatest inequity in our current health insurance system, and it really needs to be addressed, Bloomberg said. If those states increase eligibility, they would temporarily receive more federal funding than what it would cost to expand Medicaid. That may not be much of an inducement for conservative politicians reluctant to be seen as getting in bed with Obamacare, said Greg Shaw, a political science professor at Illinois Wesleyan University, who has written about the political debate over health care. Efforts to make permanent the temporary provisions of the COVID-19 relief bill are underway. Okay, and in a related effort from The Hill, over 200,000 sign up for ACA plans during Biden's special enrollment plan. More than 200,000 people signed up for health coverage on federal Obamacare exchanges in the first 2 weeks of a special pandemic enrollment period, according to federal statistics released last Wednesday. An executive order signed by President Biden in January allows uninsured Americans to sign up for coverage on healthcare.gov from February 15th through May 15th. Most states which operate their own exchanges have also extended open enrollment, which is typically available only for qualifying life events such as getting married, a job loss, or a move. According to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the number of signups from February 15th to February 28th was nearly three times higher than during the same period last year, when only 76,000 people signed up. Nearly 30 million people were uninsured in 2019 before the pandemic, but the Trump administration opted not to open a special enrollment period for them during the pandemic, despite doing so for natural disasters in the past. The Trump administration slashed budgets for outreach and made little effort to publicize any of its Affordable Care Act open enrollment periods. The Biden administration has pledged $50 million towards an advertising campaign to promote the special enrollment period, and this week announced $2.3 million in additional funding for 30 Navigator groups, which provide outreach, education, and enrollment assistance, particularly in underserved communities. Navigators face significant funding cuts under the Trump administration. Okay, well, unfortunately, one of the weird things that's created by expanding access to Obamacare for higher income people and having basically red states refusing to expand Medicaid, even though they're allowed to do it and 100% of the costs are covered, is that, well, actually, this relief bill will likely succeed in extending more generous premium tax subsidies to middle-class Americans, but it appears destined to fail in covering uninsured people in poverty. Much remains for that. Okay, but again, I'd like to reemphasize that the tax credits that deal with children and families is going to cut child poverty by an estimated one half or more. And I'd like to highlight at this point, basically children, which have been forgotten somewhat in the COVID era. And I'd like to highlight a bonus article, one of my newer features in the show. You can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT and you can find a link to this article. Science and society are failing children in the COVID era. The school reopening debate points toward a broader range of problems facing the young. And this gets into a lot of issues of all the social and health problems that our youth have faced in general, but much, much more exacerbated by the pandemic. And much of the focus of children has been by way of schools, And as an example of that, let's look at this article from The Hill. Biden faces criticism over push to vaccinate teachers. The Biden administration is defending the president's decision to prioritize vaccinations for teachers and school staff. The plan announced last Tuesday uses the administration's partnership with pharmacies to prioritize giving educators at least one dose of coronavirus vaccine this month. In making the announcement, Biden said educators should be treated like essential employees. Celine Gounder, an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist at New York University, who advised the Biden transition team on COVID-19, tweeted that the move, quote, doesn't make any sense. Gounder argued that older, at-risk teachers should already be getting vaccinated under current priority groups. She noted pharmacies are not getting any additional allocations. Without extra supply, Gounder said pharmacies would be taking vaccine away from higher-risk persons and communities of color to vaccine young, healthy teachers. This is an anti-equity move, she said. More than 30 states in the District of Columbia already put teachers in a priority group for vaccines, but Biden said he is using the, quote, full authority of the federal government in directing every state to do the same. Responding to Gounder's criticism, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that the initiative is intended not just for teachers, but also for a more diverse workforce that includes bus drivers, janitorial workers, and child care workers. So our view is actually that this step is one that is meant to help communities of color, help students who are already being disproportionately disadvantaged by schools being closed. Bioethics experts argue the priority should remain vaccinating people who are most at risk of getting seriously ill based on the age and health, not their job. By far, the fairest, most principled, most transparent way of allocating the vaccines would be to first try to protect those who are most likely to get very sick or die, said Daniel Salmasi, director of the Kennedy Institute of Ethics at Georgetown University. We're jumping way, way ahead of that if a teacher who's 28 years old and healthy is getting a vaccine ahead of a 64-year-old with diabetes and asthma. We ought to be reaching out to the people who are most in need and making special effort to reach out to those who have been most seriously affected by the pandemic. Biden's initiative goes above and beyond guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which recommended teachers get vaccinated, but did not single it out as essential. Biden acknowledged this last Tuesday by pointing to anxieties among teachers and parents. So I've commented on this before. It's been an ongoing argument. And it is an interesting question, you know, Biden saying how he wants to follow the science, but he goes well beyond the CDC guidance with schools by really pushing teachers above and beyond other priority groups. Well, and I think the real question is, and larger question, is the prioritization of children's health in this. The thing that I've talked about throughout the pandemic that I think illustrates this the best is that we live in a society, for whatever reason, has basically kept bars open and closed schools. So we haven't had a very integrated, holistic approach with risk. And because, for instance, here locally, the local health department, the health board, has the ability to close down schools, but doesn't have the ability to close down bars. They do with what's in their purview, but they don't have authority over areas that are much more risky. So just a defect in one of the many defects in our system. And as I've pointed out before, there's been much more focus on teachers and even parents than students themselves. And of course, the continuing big discrepancy in schools is that while we know the science that if you open schools with a lot of safety precautions, you can open them fairly safely, we know that a lot of schools, those that are most vulnerable and in those vulnerable communities, are actually less likely when it comes down to it to be able to follow all those guidelines and may end up, for whatever forces, to be opening when they're not as safe as they could be. The good news is that rates in the community have gone down, so therefore everybody's a little bit safer, but the rates are still much higher than what the CDC recommends for full opening for schools in many, many communities. Okay, well, as vaccines roll out, we have this big announcement today, this from CNN. CDC releases highly anticipated guidance for people fully vaccinated against COVID-19. New guidelines from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say people fully vaccinated against COVID-19 can safely visit with other vaccinated people and small groups of unvaccinated people in certain circumstances. but there are still some important safety precautions needed. The guidelines were announced at the White House COVID-19 response team briefing today. COVID-19 continues to exert a tremendous toll on our nation. Like you, I want to be able to return to everyday activities, engage with our families, friends, and community, CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said at the White House briefing on Monday. Science and the protection of public health must guide us as we begin to resume these activities. Today's action represents an important first step. It is not our final destination. As more people get vaccinated, levels of COVID-19 infection decline in communities. And as our understanding of COVID immunity improves, we look forward to updating these recommendations to the public. The CDC defines people who are fully vaccinated as those who are 2 weeks past their second dose of the Moderna and Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine, or 2 weeks past the single dose of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. There is growing evidence that people who are vaccinated don't spread COVID-19, but scientists are still trying to understand how long vaccine protection lasts. The level of precautions taken should be determined by the characteristics of the unvaccinated people who remain unprotected against COVID-19, the guidelines said. The new CDC guidance says fully vaccinated people can visit other vaccinated people indoors without masks or physical distancing. Visit indoors with unvaccinated people from a single household without masks or physical distancing if the unvaccinated people are at low risk of severe disease. Vaccinated people can skip quarantine and testing if exposed to someone who has COVID-19 but are asymptomatic, but they should monitor for symptoms for 14 days. However, people who are fully vaccinated still need to take precautions in many scenarios. The guidelines say fully vaccinated people must wear a mask and keep good physical distance around the unvaccinated who are at increased risk of severe COVID-19, or if the unvaccinated person has a household member who is at higher risk. And they must wear masks and physically distance when visiting unvaccinated people who are from multiple households. In addition, fully vaccinated people should continue basic safety precautions, including wearing a mask that fits well and keeping physical distance in public, avoiding medium and large-sized crowds, avoiding poorly ventilated public spaces, washing hands frequently, and getting tested for COVID if they feel sick. The guidelines say that the risk of infection in social activities, like going to the gym or restaurant, is lower for the fully vaccinated. However, people should still take precautions as transmission risk in these settings is higher and increases the more unvaccinated people there are there. The CDC travel recommendations have not changed for the unvaccinated. The guidelines still say that with high case numbers, the CDC recommends that you do not travel at this time. The benefits of reducing social isolation and relaxing some measures such as quarantine requirements may outweigh the residual risk of fully vaccinated people becoming ill with COVID-19 or transmitting SARS-CoV-2 to others, the guideline said. There are several activities that fully vaccinated people can resume now at low risk to themselves while being mindful of the potential risk of transmitting the virus to others. Okay, so really the big thing in here is for vaccinated people to be careful when they're around people who are known to be at higher risk for severe illness, are known to have somebody close to them who's at risk for severe illness, or if you're in around a bunch of people from multiple households or of unknown status. So be careful to protect others, even though if you're largely protected by the vaccine. Okay, well, as vaccination is rolling out, we have more things going on with this kind of change. This from The Hill. Retailers fear a return of the mask wars. Retailers and grocery stores are fearing a resurgence of the mask wars from earlier in the pandemic, as Texas and other states start scaling back coronavirus restrictions. Nationwide chains that have COVID-19 rules in place for both employees and customers are worried about the confusion and conflict that's likely to ensue as some states lift mask mandates for indoor spaces, but stores keep them in place. Industry groups and major companies with operations in Texas are already saying they plan to stick with their own coronavirus mitigation measures and guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, regardless of changes at the state level. Relaxing common sense, non-intrusive safety protocols like wearing masks is a mistake, said Jason Brewer, Executive Vice President of Communications and State Affairs at the Retail Industry Leaders Association. Going backwards on safety measures will unfairly put retail employees back in the role of enforcing guidelines still recommended by the CDC and other public health advocates. In response to lifting mask mandates, the National Retail Federation stressed that businesses have the right to establish and enforce their own policies. Retail stores are private entities. If they require you to wear a mask in their stores and you choose not to, that store can refuse admission or service, said Bill Thorne, the National Retail Federation Senior Vice President of Communications and Public Affairs. The Business Roundtable, which advocates for top CEOs across various sectors, including many consumer-facing ones, launched a campaign calling on America's leading employers to ramp up engagement with employees, suppliers, and customers for extended mask wearing, as well as vaccine distribution. Lifting mask mandates could also jeopardize the safety of pharmacies and grocers that are gearing up as vaccination centers to administer millions of shots in the coming months, Brewer said. And what's brewing in the near future is still uncertain. This from The Hill, former Biden COVID-19 advisor. We are in the eye of the hurricane right now. Michael Osterholm, a former Biden advisor on COVID-19, warned on Sunday that although progress was being made in combating the coronavirus pandemic, the threat from new variants still loomed. Last time I was on your show 4 weeks ago, the B117 variant that had about 1-4% of the virus we are seeing in communities across the country. Today, it's up to 30-40%, Osterholm said. And what we've seen in Europe, when we hit that 50% mark, you'll see cases surge. So right now, we do have to keep America as safe as we can from this virus by not letting up on any of the public health measures we've taken, and we need to get people vaccinated as quickly as we can. And remember, folks, this is a pandemic. It's worldwide. We're not a nation unto ourselves. This from the Washington Post. Much of the world is seeing coronavirus cases fall, but Brazil's outbreak is worse than ever. While much of the world is using restrictions and vaccines to try to tame the coronavirus, Brazil's outbreak is worse than it has ever been. Deaths have hit a new high, averaging 1,208 people per day over the past week. Public hospital occupancy is peaking. Health systems in more than half of the country's 26 states are at or near capacity, and a highly transmissive and potentially more dangerous variant is spreading nationwide. From the earliest days, the severity of Brazil's outbreak has set the country apart from its peers. Under the chaotic leadership of President Jair Bolsonaro, the country has been consumed by internal divisions set upon by medical quacks, unable to pull itself out from the abyss. More than 250,000 Brazilians are now dead, a toll surpassed only by the United States. The country's vaccination campaign is bogged down in shortages and delays. In this scenario, if nothing is done, by March, people will be fighting for both hospital beds and graves in the cemetery, said Domingos Alves, director of the Health Intelligence Laboratory at the University of Sao Paulo. We are going to need to open new graveyards to bury the bodies. Health analysts warn that the global implications are significant. Brazil has shown a capacity to spawn new, potentially more dangerous mutations of the coronavirus. The variant known as P1, which was discovered earlier this year, has stampeded the Amazonian city of Manaus, leading to more deaths in January and February than in all of 2020. If Brazil does not control the virus, it will be the largest open laboratory in the world for the virus to mutate, said Miguel Nicolelis, an epidemiologist and neuroscientist at Duke University. It could not only be the epicenter of the pandemic, but the epicenter of the dissemination of more lethal and infectious variants. It is in the interest of the entire planet. And of course, this Brazilian, so-called Brazilian variant, is here in the U.S.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch. And I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, let's get on with the local and state update. And in order to understand the local and state situation, need to look a little bit at what's happening nationally. We've seen infection rate plateaus have stepped up with each successive surge, the first and second, third in most communities and states. In the first surge that we had originally, we leveled off back down at a level of about 20,000 cases per day. The second large surge, we settled back in to a plateau of about 40,000 cases per day. And this third, very much larger surge, we seem to be settling back into a plateau of about 60,000 cases per day. And Ohio has had a similar looking pattern. Of course, this probably doesn't mean that this current plateau is three times as bad as the first one, because there are changes in testing. So that'll be a little bit attenuated. But definitely, we're looking at plateaus that are no better and likely worse than what we've seen earlier in the pandemic. So relaxing what we're doing, particularly with the variants which per case are more dangerous, is definitely something we need to pay attention to. But of course, we've made enough progress. People are anxiously, eagerly looking to see what the end of the pandemic and the next step may look like. This from the Dayton Daily News. Governor DeWine, no more masks once COVID cases fall to 50 per 100,000 people. Exactly 1 year after Ohio began its battle with the coronavirus pandemic, Governor Mike DeWine last Thursday said there is a clear path to lift all public health orders. When Ohio gets down to 50 cases per 100,000 people for 2 weeks, all health orders will be lifted, he said. Public health orders that would be lifted once Ohio meets a threshold of 50 cases or fewer per 100,000 Ohioans include wearing masks in public spaces, 6 feet of social distancing, and capacity reductions for businesses. We are now on the offense in this virus, DeWine said, with COVID-19 vaccines, which he has called the most powerful weapon against this disease, available in every community. To date, we have vaccinated over 1.8 million Ohioans, he said, with cases in nursing homes down to one-tenth of what they were at the height of the coronavirus outbreak. DeWine said the state has been a leader in getting children back in the classroom and vaccinating educators, older Ohioans, and those with developmental disabilities. Now, one of my kind of pet peeves in this kind of reporting is, while I may be a data freak, most people don't have any idea what 50 per 100,000 people is. So just for some context, that's why you listen to Just for the Health of It, we in the last few weeks have been 3 to 4 times higher than that rate. And we're a little bit higher than the state as a whole. So we have to reduce by like 2/3 or 3/4 to get down to this level that DeWine is talking about. And I would note that that level of 50 per 100,000 people is still quite a bit higher than what epidemiologists would normally look as like a controlled, certainly not the end of an epidemic. So in my judgment, from what I know, I would say that getting rid of masks even at that point would not be warranted. But of course, you could relax other things as far as like business capacity reductions, that type of thing. So let's not get ahead of ourselves, people. Instead, let's get ahead of the virus. Okay, well, tucked at the end of that last article states the fact that Ohio has been a leader in prioritizing those with developmental disabilities. And with that in mind, I want to do this next story from Science Daily. After old age, intellectual disability is greatest risk factor for death from COVID-19, study finds. Intellectual disability puts individuals at higher risk of dying earlier in life than the general population for a variety of medical and institutional reasons. A new study from Jefferson Health examined how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected this group, which makes up 1 to 3% of the U.S. population. The study, published in the New England Journal of Medicine Catalyst, found that intellectual disability was second only to older age as a risk factor for dying from COVID-19. The chances of dying from COVID-19 are higher for those with intellectual disability than they are for people with congestive heart failure, kidney disease, or lung disease, says lead author Dr. Jonathan Gleason. That is a profound realization that we have not, as a healthcare community, fully appreciated until now. The results showed that those with intellectual disabilities were 2.5 times more likely to contract COVID-19, were about 2.7 times more likely to be admitted to the hospital, and almost 6 times more likely to die from the infection than the general population. Our failure to protect these deeply vulnerable individuals is heartbreaking, said co-author Dr. Wendy Ross, a developmental and behavioral pediatrician at the and director for the Center for Autism and Neurodiversity at Jefferson Health. I believe that if we can design a system that is safe and accessible for people with intellectual disabilities, it will benefit us all. The author writes that patients with intellectual disabilities may have less ability to comply with strategies that reduce the risk of infection, such as masking and social distancing. In addition, the researchers showed that these patients are more likely to have additional health conditions that contribute to more severe course of COVID-19 disease. The results of the study highlight how these issues become compounded in this population. We need to understand more about what is happening with these patients, said Dr. Gleason. I do believe that patients and their caregivers should be prioritized for vaccination and healthcare services. We should reflect on why we have failed this vulnerable population and how we can better serve them during the health crisis and into the future. Even prior to the pandemic, individuals with intellectual disabilities have had poor health outcomes. We need to do much better. So I'm proud that Ohio has taken the lead in putting people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in the high priority, particularly those that are in congregate care facilities, which adds a whole nother layer of the chance of getting infected. Okay, well, back to the local update. In Lucas County, for the average number of daily cases over the last 7 days, we've had 84 per day on average, and that's down slightly from 98 the week before and up from 70 the week before. So we seem to be hovering between that 75-85 range. And in Ohio, 79 of 88 Ohio counties are still considered high incidence. We've had 4 more that have moved out of the high incidence or moved down from the high incidence to moderate incidence. So there's a total of 9 now. The testing positivity rates, the percent of people who seek a test, who get a test and are positive, has moved down to 5.7% from 7.1% the previous week in Lucas County. So that is good, and we're getting near to the level of 5%, which is considered a level of testing adequate in the community. So that's good. We're getting there. And the state of Ohio has got there and has actually been there for a few weeks. Their testing positivity rate for the entire state has dropped to 3.2%, dropping slightly from the week before. Okay, well, in really good news, in Lucas County, the number of active COVID-19 cases dropped to 5, only 5, 2 residents and 3 staff in the most recent week. That is by far the lowest we've had since the beginning of the pandemic, and it's been around 30 the previous couple weeks. So the vaccinations work. Get the residents and staff vaccinated. Woohoo! So great news. Now, in Ohio, new hospitalizations are still continuing to trend down steadily, but in Lucas County, they seem to have leveled off. So hopefully, Lucas County is not the canary in the coal mine for the state as far as the future. But I must say, from the past, we've often served that role. Okay, well, as far as the death rate, still can't really report on that because they're having problems at the state with both timeliness and trying to reconcile death data. So we'll have to wait for that later. And that's just to emphasize another point that public health is often about assessment and surveillance. You need to know data to know what's going on. And may the state sort that out sooner than later. It's been like a month since they've been fussing around with that. Okay, well, more good news. I guess at the University of Toledo, their cases, although they went up somewhat to 23, are still at a relatively low level of what they've had historically. And the surveillance testing, which is the random testing of students, continue to have a low positivity rate of 0.4% this most recent week and the week prior. And we had a slight reduction in the number of identified infections in Lucas County schools. 70 identified infections were reported in the most recent week. Okay, well, vaccines, let's look at that with state, local, and national. National first. In America, we've had almost 60 million people who've got one or more doses, and that's like 17.7%. In the state, we've had over 2 million people receive at least their first dose, and we've had over 78,000 in Lucas County. Each of those is 17 point something percent. So we've seen a little bit of convergent. Lucas County was ahead of the state and national for a while, but it looks like that actually the nation as a whole has passed up Ohio and Lucas County. Okay, well, and one thing I'm going to start tracking and reporting on regularly that I talked about last week is the racial ethnic disparity in vaccination. So when I reported on this earlier, blacks were 38% as likely to be vaccinated as whites. Well, that's moved up to 44% as likely to be vaccinated as whites. Not a massive increase, but an increase. So looking to see that gap decrease. We are making some progress, but have a long ways to go. But the good news is, and it's about time, is vaccinations just got easier in Ohio. Woo-hoo-hoo! This from the Dayton Daily News. Ohio unveils central COVID-19 vaccine scheduling tool. The Ohio Department of Health unveiled a central coronavirus scheduling tool today to make the sign-up process easier for Ohioans. Residents can visit gettheshot.coronavirus.ohio.gov. Okay, I'll repeat that at the end of the article. To schedule an appointment, it's accessible on computers, smartphones, and tablets. Ohioans can use the tool to determine if they are eligible to receive the vaccine, schedule appointments, and receive updates and reminders, Governor Mike DeWine said. Residents will be able to register for the state's mass vaccination sites using the tool. Vaccine providers are required to schedule vaccines through the system or another scheduling system that interfaces with the portal. We believe that this will streamline the scheduling process, reduce data lags, and provide real-time information on vaccination process, the governor said. So again, that site is gettheshot.coronavirus.ohio.gov. Way to go, Ohio. Okay, well, for those who have poor internet access or have language issues, you can call 211 locally to get help with vaccinations. If you're over the age 65 and would like some help, you can call the Area Office on Aging locally at 419-382-0624. Or if you're a Lucas County resident, you can visit any library branch to schedule an appointment or call 419-259-5200. Well, folks, you're listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, as vaccine efforts keep ramping up and getting better and better, we still have issues that we're going to be running into sooner or later. This from the Hill. 41% say they are not willing to receive coronavirus vaccine. 41% of voters said they are not willing to get the coronavirus vaccine, according to a new Harvard-Harris poll released exclusively to The Hill last Monday. The same survey found that 59% of respondents said they were willing to receive the vaccine. Among those who said they were unwilling to get the vaccine, 66% said they were concerned about side effects, while another 33% said they did not believe it was effective. 27% said they were not concerned about the virus, 23% said it should go to more at-risk individuals, and 17% said they had health concerns. The single most concerning number in this poll is that 4 in 10 of those who have not been vaccinated do not want to take the vaccine. This includes 60% of black voters, polling director Mark Penn told The Hill. So this is kind of a good news, bad news thing with vaccination efforts. The good news is that it's becoming easier and easier to get a shot. The bad news is part of that is because what I would call the low-hanging fruit, the people who are desperate to get a shot, is starting to run out, and we're going to have to start working much harder to reach vulnerable populations, as the final goal is to get 75% to 85% of adults in America vaccinated. We are now at about 22% of adults in America that have received at least one dose. So we're not even close to a third of the way there yet. And already we're going to start to see issues with finding enough people who want vaccines. A story that accents that, this from the Tennessean, the Nashville Tennessean. Tennessee to move to next COVID-19 vaccine phase in part due to lack of demand. Tennessee will transition to the next stage of Corona vaccine distribution today, offering doses to more than 1 million residents of all ages with serious health conditions, state officials announced last week. This transition is caused by a combination of surging vaccine supply and vaccine hesitancy, which has left doses sitting unused in some rural counties where fewer people want the vaccine, said Dr. Lisa Percy, the Tennessee Health Commissioner. Percy said this week the state would move ahead to Phase 1C, as some counties, currently vaccinating teachers and people age 65 and older, had run out of eligible residents seeking vaccine. I've got about 12 to 15 counties statewide who are sitting on product because they don't have demand, Percy said last Monday. They are wanting to go to 1C already, and we just started 1B on Monday. Tennessee's rapid advancement through vaccine phases is a double-edged sword. The next phase will open availability to one of the largest population groups in the state and help protect Tennesseans with serious conditions that make them much more vulnerable to the coronavirus. Tennessee has above average rates of most of these conditions, so much of the state is now poised for vaccination. However, part of the reason the state has advanced so quickly is a lack of interest in vaccination in some rural areas, where Piercy said as few as 30% of eligible residents seek out the vaccine. They may leave lingering pockets of vulnerability in rural areas, which are already generally less healthy than Tennessee's more metropolitan counties. Counties where fewer residents decide to be vaccinated will likely stay susceptible to outbreaks long after other areas have achieved herd immunity. We are going to continue to live with this, and at some point there will be a transition from a pandemic to just an endemic, which is what the flu is, Piercy said. You will see it pop up every now and then, and I do expect us to continue seeing outbreaks where vaccine uptake is low. Okay, well, in most cases, I'm not a big fan of the pharmaceutical companies, but I would say the accomplishments with these vaccines from a technological point of view is astounding, even, dare say, miraculous. And I would advise anyone who has the opportunity to take any of the three vaccines available to take them. They are highly effective and safe, way safer than living in a pandemic. But on that note, I'd like to switch to a little bit of a different context, a more normal state for me, which is of a deep skepticism of pharmaceuticals and the pharmaceutical industry. So this from Mad in America. Recovery rate 6 times higher for those who stop antipsychotics within 2 years. New research finds that people with serious mental illness who stop taking antipsychotics after initial treatment are more likely to recover, even accounting for baseline severity. Specifically, the researchers found that those who stopped taking antipsychotic medication within 2 years of first taking the drug were almost 6 times more likely to recover from serious mental illness and were only 13.4 times as likely to be rehospitalized. According to the researchers, some studies have shown that some patients derive a short-term benefit from using antipsychotic drugs. Most of these studies have taken place over the course of a few weeks to months. However, people diagnosed with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and even depression are often prescribed antipsychotic drugs for long-term use for the rest of their lives in many cases. But research into long-term outcomes has found a disturbing picture. Multiple studies indicate that after 2 to 3 years of antipsychotic treatment, persons with schizophrenia and affective psychosis not prescribed antipsychotic medication start performing better than patients with those prescribed antipsychotic medication. And in another story about in the mental health field from the pharmaceutical angle, this also from Mad in America, another failed study of, quote, personalized depression treatment. Due to lackluster antidepressant study results, researchers test if subgroups of depressed patients show greater improvement. An effort to identify subgroups of people diagnosed with depression who will see a substantial benefit from antidepressants has come up empty. The study was published in the top-tier journal JAMA Psychiatry. studies of antidepressant effectiveness generally find that the average effect of the drug is clinically insignificant when compared to the placebo effect. Indeed, when published and unpublished trials are included, only 49% of the studies found that antidepressants were no better than the placebo. Researchers have suggested that the placebo effect accounts for all or almost all of the drug's impact on symptoms. Okay, and sticking in that vein of pharmaceuticals, we turn to something that has more of an impact coming from the drug dealers, that is the physicians who prescribe the drugs. This from Science Daily. Most women receive inappropriate treatment for urinary tract infections. Nearly half of women with uncomplicated urinary tract infections receive the wrong antibiotics, and almost three-quarters receive prescriptions for longer than necessary, with inappropriately long treatment durations more common in rural areas, according to a study of private insurance claims data published in Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology, the Journal of the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology in America. Accumulating evidence suggests that patients have better outcomes when we change prescribing from broad-acting to narrow-spectrum antibiotics and from longer to shorter durations, Butler said. Promoting optimal antimicrobial use benefits the patient and society by preventing avoidable adverse events, microbiome disruption, and antibiotic-resistant infections. Okay, well, I'll take this opportunity to drop a related gem upon you. Okay, ladies out there, if you are experiencing regular or chronic urinary tract infections, one thing you can do is stop bringing chicken into your house. This is an example of a zoonosis, which is a transmission of disease or pathogenic bacteria from animals to humans. And the fact is, no matter how careful you are, if you're bringing dead chicken carcasses into your home, no matter how well you try to prevent contamination, you end up spreading pathogenic bacteria around your home, which end up seeding and increasing the chance of urinary tract infections. So, another argument for at least one facet of vegetarianism, maybe give up on poultry for a while. See what happens. It may even be good for your health. Remember, if you want nutrition in two words, here it is: beans and greens.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning: use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever. Callus always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, folks. Well, if you're out there battling with depression and you can't really wait for social justice to solve all our problems, here's an article from the National Association on Mental Illness, one of their blogs, that may be helpful. What to do when your friends and family are unsupportive of your depression. When you're going through depression, it can be even more difficult to cope when your friends and family are unsupportive. It can even worsen symptoms when someone you're close to makes cold or thoughtless comments or blames you for your symptoms. So, what do you do in this situation? Well, the ideal is to surround yourself with people who are understanding of what you're going through or trying through or willing to try and understand. This is not always possible. Here are some things you can do for yourself when those closest to you don't understand. Acknowledge the situation. At a certain point, you must realize and acknowledge that not everyone will understand. There could be a certain reason they're behaving that way that has nothing to do with you. It's possible this is an ingrained and subconscious behavior if they grew up learning that. It's unacceptable to show any signs of mental health issues or that symptoms of mental illness are signs of, quote, weakness. or they may be older and from a generation where mental illness comes with more stigma than it does now. Be your own cheerleader. At the end of the day, you must be your own greatest support. Although it takes practice, treat yourself with kindness and gentleness. Talk to yourself in a positive tone. If you are negative with yourself, it will only worsen your symptoms. If your mind is going in circles and going over negative things, try to find different ways to change your thoughts and your mentality. Look for different ways to break the pattern, such as reframing your thoughts from, I hate myself, to, I have depression and need to give myself compassion. Don't believe depression misconceptions. Whatever anyone says, depression is not a reflection of laziness or weakness. Depression is a medical illness. No matter what you might think, the concept that you're asking for help purely to, quote, get attention is a myth. Depression is about hanging on until you can start getting better. Remind yourself of these facts, especially when someone is being unsupportive. Understand that other people struggle too. It's possible that a friend or family member cannot support you because they are dealing with their own mental health problem. They may be sympathetic to what you're going through, but aren't able to support you. If someone is too entrenched in their own issues, it doesn't mean they don't care about you. It just means they can't support you because their internal resources are simply all used up trying to care for themselves. Try to be patient or even offer your support to that person if you can. Sometimes the best way to feel better is to help someone else. Look for other sources of support. If you find that your friends and family aren't giving you the support you need, consider looking for others who can. Consider joining a depression support group, either by attending one in person or looking for one online. At first, you might be wary of opening up to a group of strangers, but you may find that those going through a common struggle and experience can be great friends to have. Ask for help explicitly. Don't hesitate to be direct when asking people for help. It might be that your friends and families are willing and wanting to support you, but they just don't realize what you need. They may not even realize how much help you need because they see the strong exterior you show. Most people can't read minds and will be more willing to help you if you give them explicit directions. Cut out negativity. If you have gone through these steps and people are still being negative in your life, knowing what you're going through, you may need to end those relationships. Some people are just mean-spirited or hurtful, and you may have to cut them out of your life for your own mental well-being. If you can't end the relationship, you should find methods to limit contact or cope against their comments. Although this is one of the hardest things to do, don't be afraid to minimize contact with people who are hurtful towards you. Turn negativity into a positive. Sometimes you can use your emotion like anger to your benefit. Instead of channeling these negative emotions, feeling them all internally and beating yourself up for the way the relationship is, use this anger and emotion for something positive. Go get exercise and fresh air, or smash up some ceramic tiles and use the pieces for a mosaic, or even angry clean your house. By doing something physical, you can release your energy and emotions, and it's healthy to have an outlet for your negativity and anger. It's certainly difficult to go through depression. It's even harder when your close ones aren't supportive. However, even if your friends and family don't give you the support you need, you can still give the compassion and support you need for yourself, to yourself. Okay, folks, reaching out for help is not a problem. It may very well be the solution. And something to help you out with that, here in Ohio, we have an Ohio Care Line, 1-800-720-9617. I'll repeat that at the end. The Ohio Care Line is a toll-free emotional support call service created by the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Behavioral health professionals staff the Care Line 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They offer confidential support in times of personal or family crisis when individuals may be struggling to cope with challenges in their lives. When callers need additional services, they will receive assistance and connection to local providers. Again, folks, that's the Ohio Care Line, 1-800-720-9616. That's 1-800-720-9616. Okay, folks, well, I know for my physical and mental health, I'm looking forward to spring, and one of the things I like to do is bike. I don't have a car, so it helps me get around, but also it's invigorating both physically and emotionally. So I want to end it with this public health story from futurity.org. Northeast U.S., walking, biking could save billions and lives. Investing in walking and biking, coupled with proposed emission caps could save hundreds of lives and billions of dollars each year in the Northeast United States. Infrastructure investments to promote bicycling and walking, proposed by the Transportation and Climate Initiative, a regional collaborative of 12 northeastern states and Washington, D.C., could save as many as 770 lives and $7.6 billion annually. These findings appear in the Journal of Urban Health. The analysis shows that the economic benefit of lives saved from increased walking and cycling far exceeds the estimated annual investment it would cost to promote such infrastructure, without even considering the added benefits of reducing air pollution and increasing access to climate-friendly transportation modes. Our findings demonstrate how investments in climate-friendly transportation options like biking and walking can reap huge health and economic benefits at the local level, says Patrick Kinney, the study's senior author and professor for the improvement of urban health. Okay, one last bonus article, articles that are worth reading but I don't have time to cover completely on my show, that you can access through my website, toppun.com/blog/WAKT, where you can access these bonus articles and links to all the articles that I cover on my show. So this last article, killings by police declined after Black Lives Matter protests. Police killings fell by about 20% on average in municipalities that had Black Lives Matter protests compared to those that did not. The study also found body camera use and community policing increased in places with the most active movements. Okay, well, that's public health. You look at non-traditional interventions, in this case, Black Lives Matter protests, and it actually results in less police killings. Woohoo! Way to go, public health workers, you Black Lives Matter protesters. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.